Yo, guys, we're back to the next episode of Primal Alchemy's Red Pill Initiation Hour, here with your host, Chris Story. A few things to touch base on, guys, before we kick today's episode off. The first being a massive thank you to the continuous love and support you guys show me at the end of each and every episode. And I say this at the beginning of every episode because I really do mean it, guys. Your feedback is critical for me to be able to really evolve this podcast into what I envision it to be. I need the good feedback. I need the bad feedback. I need something from you guys so I know how to better it for you. You guys are giving me a few hours of your day to listen to me ramble, chat shit, hopefully open up that third eye in the process. And I want to make it as beneficial and as entertaining as possible in the process. So your feedback is critical. So if you could please drop me a review on iTunes, on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, on Stitcher, on YouTube. If you're listening to this on Spotify, then please jump over to Instagram afterwards and hit me up at Primal Alchemy UK. And just let me know what you think. As always, I always drop you guys an exclusive discount code. That's the code REDPILL. That's the code REDPILL that when used at primalalchemy.co.uk, you'll get an exclusive discount at checkout with anything in your shopping basket. Again, guys, if you're brand new to the Primal Alchemy brand, this is your first time being introduced to us and myself, then check the website out. We've got our Vitruvian Protein, which is our organic whey protein superfood blend. It's got adaptogens, nootropics, prebiotics, other high vibrational superfoods, all formulated into one blend just for you. Nice and convenient, and it's powerful as fuck. Also, we've got our Ancestral Potential coaching programs. If you want to work with me one-to-one, we can do some exercise programs, nutrition programs, our Enlightened Biohacking programs. Pretty far out there, guys. Definitely rings a bell and is in alignment with today's episode, which I will now move on to, which is episode 33 with Dr. Dean Radin. So who is Dr. Dean Radin, guys? Well, I came across Dean's work way back in university. Dean is a parapsychology researcher, and he's one of the senior scientists at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And I found out about his work, a few years back, where I read his book Supernormal, which is the science, basically investigating the science of yoga and really brings together a collective evidence for extraordinary abilities such as psychic phenomena, precognition, clairvoyance, telepathy, and some other cool mental powers. Really, really interesting, guys. And I reached out to Dean and he was happy to come on. And this one's great because this one really gives some validity to a lot of the stuff that I talk about and a lot of the stuff that the Primal Alchemy brand pushes in terms of being able to reconnect with a power that's innate inside of us, but has been forgotten and lies dormant. You can call these godly powers, you can call them supernatural powers, but they are powers that are innate to each and every one of us, and we've just forgotten. So yeah, talking to Dean was great. He let us know what the research or the latest research is on this topic, what he's currently researching at his facility. You know what, let's just jump straight into it. I tend to blabber on a little bit on these intros, so that's another thing that you can let me know when it comes to the feedback. Do you guys actually listen to this? Do you listen to this intro? Or do you just skip it? Let me know. Then it saves me like a good 4 minutes of chatting shit when I could just start the episode straight off. Anyway, guys, hope you enjoy. Morpheus, show these fools what's up.
You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
As above, so below. What lies without resides within. Time for growth to begin. Mental, physical, and spiritual. We find balance with all three as we focus on totality. The whole, not the half. This is for those on a spiritual path. looking for the clues to the answers of life. But the truth ain't always nice, so leave your ego at the door. Let your inner lion roar and your spirit soar as we go deep down to the molecular level. Tap into the body with some yogic breath. Throw in some calisthenics for a true strength test. Like the shamans of old, we use the nature to heal with a little bit of DMT to reveal. This whole life journey is a little surreal, and your mind needs a leader, not a follower in life. Let your mind be the master and you pay a hefty price. This next 60 minutes is about self-mastery. It's not an easy path and it's a lifelong journey, but we up to empower with this Red Pill Initiation Hour. With this Red Pill Initiation Hour, brought to you by Primal Alchemy.
The Matrix is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
Three, two, one, and oh shit, sweet Merlin. Guys, we are back with episode 33 of the Red Pill Initiation Hour. Today's episode, guys, as always, I've been trying to keep a consistent flow of hitting you up with different subjects, different topics, in order for you to be able to piece together your own puzzle of what I'm really trying to come at you with my philosophy of what being human's about, the potential that we have inside of us. And we've covered quite a range so far in the first 33 episodes. We've gone from talking about nutrition, we've looked pretty deep into ancestral nutrition, ancestral health, and sort of really combining that with the modern day outlook on or perspective on quantum biology, quantum health. We've looked a little bit into fitness, we've looked a little bit into esotericism, which we've touched base on slightly. And through most of the episodes, you guys have probably heard me just drop bombs about magic. And you're probably thinking, what the fuck, Chris? Like, what are you on about? Magic? Bullshit. We know that doesn't exist. Well, guys, like, I've put in the time to study this for the past 10 years. And when you actually have professionals that have dedicated their life to this as well, it's evident that there is something to this magic gig. You just gotta drop the barriers. You gotta let go of these sort of social anchors, these constructs, these conditionings, programming that's keeping you from the truth. And today's guest is someone who I really do look up to, and he was very influential on my own quest of this knowledge, pursuing this back when I was at university, bunking off the lectures so I could study the shit that I was really interested in, which is what we're going to be talking about today. So we're jumping straight into it. And today's guest is Dr. Dean Radin. I'm going to let Dean explain for himself what he's about. He's a man of much experience and he's got quite the resume. So yeah, Dean, thank you for coming on, my man. And I just would, like we were saying then before we went live, it's an honor to be able to talk to you, and it's very surreal, and it's a privilege for me to be in this situation, to now be talking to guys like yourself. Like, you may not think about it when you're in the lab and you're doing all your shit, you're doing your work, but there's a younger generation coming up who are fascinated with this type of science. And it's a very niche type of science, but it's definitely a powerful branch of a science that dates back thousands and thousands of years. And it's due to people like yourself where we're really starting to get a modern day explanation, a modern day breakdown of things that, yeah, our ancestors told us tens of thousands of years ago, and we just kind of let it go over our heads, thought they were bullshitting us, but it turns out that they were pretty spot on and a lot more wiser than we gave them credit for. So yeah, Dean, if you wouldn't mind giving us a breakdown of who you are, what you're about, and yeah, letting the audience know who Dr. Dean Radin is.
Thanks, Chris. So my name is Dean Radin. I'm the chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which is a nonprofit research institute in Northern California. The Institute was started by the Apollo 14 astronaut, Edgar Mitchell, who was the sixth person to land on the moon. And Edgar's story was that on the way back to the Earth from the moon, he had a mystical experience that was sparked by if you can imagine looking out of the window and seeing the Earth about the size of a marble. So in being able to see that and contemplate the fact that when you look at the Earth from space, you don't see countries, you don't see boundaries, you don't see people, you don't see anything other than this amazingly blue ball sitting in the blackness of space. So that sparked this simply thinking about the fact that everyone he had ever known, all of our history, everything about humanity is on that tiny little blue ball in the middle of nothing, or at least in the middle of space, deep space. So something about that experience, and perhaps if you look at the history of what most of the astronauts have said, including even ones up in the space station, there's the so-called overview effect. And when you're able to step out of your home and look back on it, you don't see most of the things that we're concerned about on a day-to-day basis. What you see is, we really do live on a tiny blue ball in the middle of nowhere. As far as we can tell, we don't have alien visitors with us, but maybe we do. But the main point is that everything we know about being human is on this tiny little speck. So that expanded his awareness to the point where he had a fairly classic mystical experience, which he later learned has names, samadhi and many other names that go with these kinds of experiences. And when he came back to Earth, he was determined to figure out what that experience meant, given that it is reported throughout history. It is transformative when it happens, because it suddenly opens your eyes to a very different way of being, essentially. And coming from a scientific and military and technical background, he decided to use the tools and techniques of science to apply to those kinds of experiences. So at the Institute, we study psychic experience, mystical experience, things like channeling, mediumship, the whole range of experiences that are considered beyond the pale within the academic world, and yet are commonly reported. So we have 11 scientists on staff now. All of us are trained in traditional disciplines. Many of us have PhDs. We have PhD neuroscientists, computer science, people with a physics background. My own background is electrical engineering, physics, and psychology. And so we've all worked in conventional places and in the academic world or industrial research, but I think like a lot of people, at some point, kids who read about fairy tales and science fiction invariably begin to wonder, is any of that stuff real? Well, the first thing you do, especially if Chris, you've been talking about magic, what comes to mind when you talk about that is either stage magic, which is not what we're talking about, and it's not Harry Potter either. It's not Harry Houdini or Harry Potter. Both of those are elaborations of actual magic, of real magic. And so you talk to somebody who's not thinking about this all the time, and you talk about magic, they're thinking Harry Potter, that level of very broad and obvious in-your-face type magic. That's not what we're talking about. We are talking about the ideas in those kinds of magic. And in fact, you pursue the ideas in the laboratory, you find out that the essence of Harry Potter type magic actually is real. So we can influence the world with our thoughts. We can perceive through space and time. Those are the essence of what real magic is about. So there are techniques that developed over millennia to help people learn how to do that. And in the modern era, we can put these kinds of phenomena in the laboratory and test whether or not it's actually real. So that's why my book is called Real Magic, and it talks about that.
Yeah, it's like when I first started to get into this, like you said, most kids they start off with a fascination with science fiction, but today's modern younger generation, it's mostly kind of like how I was influenced. It's going to be through certain types of anime or Marvel, DC superhero comics.
Right.
Because you're fascinated with becoming superhuman, and these superhumans have magical powers. And then when you get into that, I started looking into mythology and lore, folklore, of getting a little bit deeper again, scratching the surface and looking into like real life occurrences of reports of magic, going into medieval Europe with alchemy, going deeper again into like Greco-Arabic magic, into the grimoires, and then you go back even further into ancient Egypt. And then as soon as you start getting into ancient Egypt, it gets very spectacular very quickly. There's so many cultures. I mean, then you go over to the Vedic valleys, and you've got the yogis, you've got the Yoga Sutras with the cities, like these superpowers that are supposedly available to the adepts, the masters of the science of yoga. And people misunderstand yoga in that they just see some pretty attractive females in some pretty tight clothing doing some stretching, but that's only one part of the system of yoga, and there's so much more to it. And just because it was one of the books that really set me off with you, with the supernormal, and it's all to do with like the cities and like the powers of these yogis, I wonder if you could just kind of break down some of the what would be classed as like the superpowers associated with these yogi masters over to the East, and what they believed they could achieve, and then some of your research that's proven that this phenomena does actually exist in today's age.
Well, in science, we don't talk about proof.
Yep.
The only place where there's proof is logic and mathematics and alcohol. There's proof. In the science, it's all about gaining data and evidence and either getting confidence in a hypothesis or not. So it sounds kind of abstract, but basically what the reason that I don't talk about proving these phenomena is because while the methods in the laboratory can give us confidence that it's real, you're never completely sure. When you start becoming sure is when you have turned the science into technology, right? So here's an iPhone. We have proof essentially that this thing does what it's supposed to do and that the science underneath it is really good because it's reliable and it works. When it comes to something like magic or the yoga cities, it doesn't work every time, but for clear reasons. We wouldn't watch sports if people were so good that they never missed the ball, or they always hit the ball exactly in the right place. Human performance is extremely variable. So we like to watch sports because of the uncertainty in it. Mm-hmm. Well, the same is true for every other kind of human performance. Nobody is 100% all the time. And it's certainly the case in any kind of subtle human performance involving perception or mental effects, it's all over the map for most people. So the ones who we would consider to be extremely talented, have very high talent in these domains, they might be reliable to maybe 60% of the time, but not too much beyond that. And we talk about the huge stories about powers from the yogis and magicians throughout history. They too, they'll be accurate sometimes, and they'll be able to do things occasionally, but certainly nowhere near what we see from movies and from fiction. So that's important to understand then, that we're not talking about comic books, talking about what happens in real life. Mm-hmm. So it's real. It's just not as dramatic, typically. So in the yogic tradition is one of many traditions developed in cultures around the world, all of which started in shamanism in one form or another. So we're talking about 10 to probably 30 or 40,000 years ago, where it was noticed that some kids would grow up and they were different than the other kids because they seemed to talk to things that nobody else could see, and they had impressions about things that would later come true. Very early on, it was recognized that these kids had special talents, and they were trained then to be the shaman. So the shaman in the early tribes were the healers and in many cases the warriors as well. And the tribe would rely on them to keep them safe and to find food. So if a shaman could not tell where the animals were going to be tomorrow, the tribe could kill them. The shaman is not very useful if they're not going to be able to make the tribe survive. So through a process of selection, you can imagine that over the years, people who ended up doing shamanistic work, oftentimes with the help of psychedelics to push them into these altered states they need to be in, they got pretty good at what they're doing. They had to, otherwise it wouldn't survive. So you jump 10,000 years in the future from shamanism, and then you're starting having civilizations that develop more formalized ways of entering these spaces of consciousness that the shamans would enter. So in northern India, or what we would today see as northern India, methods began to be developed, which we today would call meditation and yoga. That would basically take people who had at least some talent and train them how to get into these rarefied states. So yoga itself, we think of yoga today as kind of a spiritualized aerobics. And sometimes you'll have meditation during a yoga session and sometimes not. But the goal of original yoga, classical yoga, is talked about by Patanjali, an Indian sage from about 2,000 years ago. He wrote a book called the Yoga Sutras, which spells out in a very short way the nature of what yoga was about. And when you read that book, you find that the yoga part, the physical part of it, was actually a very minor role. So what we think of today as yoga as a physical thing, it's important, but that's not really what the purpose is. The purpose of the physical side of yoga is to make your body strong enough so that you're able to sit down for 8 hours a day and meditate. Mm. That's what the physical part is about. The reason why yoga turned into the way that we see it today, as you're suggesting, that they're lovely people doing lovely things in skimpy clothing, is largely a modern invention, roughly 70 years ago. It was invented by British soldiers and teachers who were living in India, who took some of the original ideas from yogic type meditation, but added on British calisthenics and Swedish gymnastics. And that amalgamation turned into what is practiced as yoga in the West today. Mm. But again, the original idea was all about meditation. So meditation, if you can imagine that every day you'll sit down for at least 8 hours a day and do nothing, at least from the point of view of from the outside. From the inside, you're also, in a sense, attempting to achieve nothing. You're attempting to achieve a state of empty mind, where there's no mind wandering, there's no monkey chatter. It's like completely silent in there. It's not easy to do that. Many people in the modern world can't do it at all. But you imagine a simpler time where we weren't saturated with the internet and cell phones and apps and all the rest of it. There was no TV. There typically weren't jobs in the way that we think of as jobs structured as they are today. So some people, in a sense, had the luxury or were passionate about going in and exploring inner space. That's what their job became, basically. When you do that, and we know this is even true today, if you sit down long enough and you meditate, you quiet your mind, you will begin to perceive things that are not local to you, meaning you'll be able to perceive things at a distance. In some very talented people, you'll find that your thoughts begin to manifest. Your thoughts push the world around. So to give an example of this, in the Yoga Sutras, there's an entire chapter or book. There's four little books. There's a book that is devoted to the idea that there are a whole range of different kinds of powers that you develop, powers of consciousness. We would now call them mostly psychic powers, things like clairvoyance, precognition, and so on. Those are what the powers are about. So we asked 1,000 people who are doing meditation practice a couple of years ago, after you started doing your practice of meditation, which of these things had you encountered? So of those things, a lot of them had to do with the mind and the body, but some of them had to do with various kinds of psychic effects, like telepathy and strange synchronicities and that sort of thing. And what we found was that of these 1,000 people, roughly 75% of them talked about things like mind-boggling synchronicities that they began to notice. And roughly a third of them started talking about psychic phenomena that they hadn't experienced before, but things like telepathy and so on, that now they began to notice. And so these are generally people who have only been meditating a couple of years. And so extend that out now to people who are meditating 20 to 40 years and doing it religiously, hours a day. You can get into some pretty strange headspaces where what we would normally think of as super psychic abilities are simply a natural consequence of being able to rest your awareness in these very deep states. So that's in a sense, the whole yoga and meditation direction is from the East. But if you go back far enough, there was no East and West. It was all basically the same thing, somewhere between Greece and India and thereabouts. East and West was the same, and it kind of split in terms of culture, but it all devolves back into the same insights that even if you go further back, you see it again and again in virtually every shamanistic tradition.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I had a recent discussion with a friend of mine called Chris Walton, and he's a performance psychologist, and he does a lot of research into what he calls the gamma mind frame, the gamma mindset. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I'm very interested with is, yeah, like altered states of consciousness and being able to induce altered states of consciousness through multiple disciplines, methodologies, protocols and practices. And one of the things I've got like an audio visual entrainment device, which it's kind of like a combination of like binaural beats combined with a little like headset visor that you put on, and it uses like phototherapy to kind of entrain your brain into certain certain states of consciousness. And through it you can do like alpha, beta, delta, but the one that it's missing that I was always super fascinated with was the gamma. And the gamma is the one that's, if you look at it on an EEG reading, it's like a really high amplitude, but really quick. And you can't seem to recreate this any other way unless you reach a certain state of consciousness yourself. So a lot of these, some of the research that Chris had done is that he had looked at, He managed to get hold of some elders from over in Tibet from a certain monastery, and he found that they could go from an alpha state of they could get into a meditative state, and they would go from a beta awakened state to an alpha state, almost like a flip of the switch, and then all of a sudden there was a massive spike and they went into a gamma state. And it's that gamma state that's associated with that collective whole, that collective consciousness, in that they could connect to something greater than themselves. And I was wondering if you have any insights on that state of consciousness in that deep gamma, gamma wave state of consciousness. Do you know anything with that?
Gamma is... I would say there's some indications that gamma is related in some way to expanded states of awareness, but that's not settled by any means.
Yeah.
And it's also true that it's very difficult to entrain the brain to gamma. You can do it for lower frequencies, but higher frequencies are much more difficult. In addition, the amplitude of EEG at gamma is really tiny. You know, if you think of a waveform has two characteristics. It's how big it is in amplitude and also how fast it is, which is frequency.
Yeah.
So gamma is a high frequency, 40 hertz and above. But the amplitude is really tiny.
Interesting, because, he said that it was really high. Okay, so that's
in a really high in a relative way, right? Because normally if you're looking at gamma, it's really tiny. There's hardly any there. So if somebody's starting to show lots of gamma in a relative sense, it's bigger, but it's nowhere near as big as what you see in the lower frequencies. Mm. It's just the way that the amplitudes are working. So it's not clear to me that the brainwave frequencies are the direction we want to go. It's almost as though like the fact that the brain has various rhythms to it are a result of billions of neurons firing in synchrony at various frequencies. So it's one of the very first things discovered about the brain, that there are different rhythms. We see some relationship between beta as everyday working awareness and alpha doing this and gamma and whatever. All of that does have a correlation with mental states. But I think the more interesting finding recently is that both in advanced meditators and in many psychedelic states, all of that goes away. The amplitude of the entire brain drops very significantly. The frequencies start getting slower and slower. And it's as though the brain has turned off. I mean, it's really freaky to see that happen. If you're looking at brain waves and you're studying somebody who's highly adept, it's like their brain turns off. At the same time that that's happening, people are then talking about having very significantly expanded awareness. And this challenges the idea that this internal awareness is a brain state. In fact, it may not be a brain state. This is one of the anomalies that neuroscientists are not quite sure what to do with it. Because if you take a psychedelic or you do advanced meditation and your brain seems to have turned off, and yet people are still not only aware, but much more aware than they are in their ordinary state. This suggests that the relationship between mind and brain is not as tight as is claimed in the neurosciences. That doesn't mean that there are correlations between thoughts and feelings and all the rest and what's happening in regions of the brain, but it does challenge the idea that the brain is causing those states. The correlation is real, but that doesn't mean it's causal. So this is now relevant to the idea that how can somebody be able to perceive what's happening 10,000 miles away, right? The ordinary senses can't do that. So something else is allowing the information to somehow get into your head. Well, if the brain can't do it, and yet you can still get the information, then some aspect of your awareness has access to information that is somewhere else or somewhen else. You can see through space and time. So that's a magical practice. And here the word magic is used because we don't know what else to call it. Someday we might have a better term, but for this point in our history, the term magic, as it has always been, is a stand-in word for because we don't have a better description of why that's possible yet. And the reason why I'm interested in it as a scientist is because it's telling us that our models of reality, our models of what humans are and what we're capable of, is missing something. It's missing something probably pretty profound. And you know it's profound because we don't even have good names for it yet. We don't know what to call it. And the only reason why I think it's worth paying attention to is because you can take these kinds of claims into the laboratory under controlled conditions and see whether or not it's actually true. You can test to see if telepathy is a real thing in such a way that you can tell that it's either some mundane explanation or not. And so we know that telepathy is not due to a mundane explanation, and it kind of begs the question then, well, how does that work? Well, the esoteric traditions can tell us something about how they thought it would work, but we actually still don't know. That's why I think it's interesting. That's the thing that draws me to continue to study these kinds of phenomena because we actually don't have a very good handle on it from a scientific perspective.
Yeah, it's it seems to be one of the weaknesses of modern day science. And just to touch back on the explanation you gave then about the brainwaves, in that it's a very reductionistic approach, in that science believes that consciousness is local, it's localized, in that it's the brain that's generating it. So when it's like that, the whole gamma mindset, it kind of throws a spanner in the works in those models, because it's like, shit, well, if the brain is not quote unquote functioning because there's not much activity going on, then where is this heightened state of hyper-consciousness and awareness coming from? It's obviously non-localized. And that is a complete paradigm-shattering revelation.
By the way, that's also why the study of these kinds of abilities is so taboo within the academic world, because it is a major challenge to the neurosciences. And again, I would say that the idea of neural correlates of consciousness, which is a term you see a lot in the neurosciences, that is undeniable. I mean, we can make brain-activated interfaces now where people can think things and the computer can figure out, based on the pattern of activity around the brain, what are they likely thinking? And that's when people talk about synthetic telepathy today. They're talking about being able to understand patterns in brain activity and decipher it, basically. So that's all real, but that's correlations. That's not saying anything about what is the act of awareness like. And that's where the mystery begins, because we don't know why we're aware. We don't know how it is that the 3 pounds of tissue inside your head is doing something which magically is making you aware of it. That is the major mystery.
It really does just kind of flip reality upside down when you start getting into this stuff. And it's been one of those that it really sets its hooks into you, and it's kind of like once you're hooked in, you're just continuously pulled through a wild journey of self-discovery, self-actualization, because the more you study in the magic, for me, it's like you're really studying yourself. You're studying the inner workings of yourself, and it's the whole process of spiritual self-discovery. And one of the things I'd like to know of you, Dean, is like, what's been, through your years of research, what's been some of the things that you've stumbled upon where it's just been like the biggest sort of almost life-changing, paradigm-shifting sort of findings that really made you question reality and what your place within it is, and just really, you really had to take a few steps back, just be like, fuck, that's going to have to take a while to digest this one and be able to integrate this back in.
I would say that probably the first episode like that was when I was 34, I had started to do experiments in things like precognition and psychokinesis. I was working at Bell Laboratories at the time, which is a big research facility in the US. And of course, Bell Labs is primarily involved in telecommunications, and at the time, cell phones were being invented and video phones and things like that. But they gave us enough free time to work on basically anything we wanted. And I decided, I think I'll do something on precognition and also on psychokinesis. So I did, and I got permission from my management to go to conferences and talk about it. So that already was pretty strange, because you don't expect a big industrial laboratory to allow people to do psychic research. But for some reason, they did. So I went to a conference and I gave a talk on the work I was doing. And at the conference, I was essentially recruited to work on a program that the U.S. government was doing, which was classified at the time. So there was psychic espionage. And there were rumors for years about such a thing, but if you weren't part of the program, of course, you would never know anything beyond the rumors. So I was invited to join that program. Ultimately, I did. And it was a top secret program. So even the code word, we now know the code words include things like Stargate and Grill Flame and so on. The code words were classified. So nobody even knew what those words meant or what they were. So anyway, so I joined that program, got all the security clearances. And after you get all of that, you get a briefing to bring you up to speed on what the program is like. Since before that, you're not allowed to read anything or hear anything. So I got the briefing, which is the same two-hour briefing that would be given to a senator or a president or general who needed to know about the program. And that's kind of mind-blowing, because what I was seeing is one case after another, usually of operational missions as opposed to laboratory studies. So these are real life, real applications of very talented psychics who are basically using clairvoyance as a kind of psychic spy. And they were able to do things that I had no idea that people could actually do it. I mean, now it was almost as though I was reading a fairy tale story or a science fiction story, but it's real. So I should say here that we're not talking about macroscopic psychokinetic stuff. That may or may not even exist, you know, like levitation and throwing lightning bolts from your fingertips and that sort of thing. that looks good in the movies, but that's not the way that this very high talent seems to work. What does work is that some people are extremely adept at using clairvoyance. So they can literally perceive through space and time and can see anything in space or time, which, as you can imagine, is really useful if you're doing espionage. So they give one example of many possible examples. And of course, and now my mind is being blown because this is within a top secret facility. I'm being presented case after case of actual episodes that were used in operational missions. One of the psychics is asked to look inside a building in northern Russia where we have no idea what's going on because the spy satellites can't see inside the building. But we're suspicious. Our government is suspicious that something is going on there because it's near a naval yard. And so it's not right on the ocean, so they figure it can't be a boat or something that they're creating. But it's something, because there's a lot of activity going on. So they ask the psychic spy what's happening inside that building. So what he describes is a submarine, which is roughly four times larger than any submarine that has ever been built. And it goes back to the National Security Council in the U.S., and they're saying, well, this is ridiculous. Nobody's going to build a submarine that's that big. And not only that, it's not connected to the ocean, so what are they going to do with it? You have this massive submarine sitting there about a mile away from the ocean. Nevertheless, that's what he found. He reported that, yeah, there's something there. And not only that, he then projected into the future and said, somehow it gets into the ocean. They're going to put this thing into the ocean. So 9 months goes by, and the spy satellites begin to see that that a canal is being built from the ocean to this building, and it wasn't there before. And sure enough, finally, this submarine comes out, goes through the canal, and gets into the ocean. And it is what we now call a Typhoon-class submarine, which is the largest that was ever built. It like dwarfs a normal submarine. It is monstrous. It's like the size of an aircraft carrier, only it's a submarine. So once it was seen, once it became visible by the spy satellites, then the National Security Council paid a little bit more attention to what was going on, because this was very unexpected, but later verified to be correct. So that's one of many cases like that. When I was being told this is all top secret. You couldn't breathe a word about any of this stuff. Now most of it is declassified, which is why I can talk about it. So that was pretty good. that was basically saying that not only were there rumors that were real, but the ability of highly talented people is astonishing. So it's astonishing mainly because, and maybe it's true in general, but as a scientist, you go through many, many years of schooling where you're taught that the world is a certain way. And here, at least within this classified environment, we're seeing, no, they left out some really interesting stuff. The world is not the way it says in the textbooks. It's much bigger than that. So there I was around 34 or 35 years old and thinking I could stay and do conventional research for the rest of my career. But how in the world can I drop this now? Right? Like something is dangling in front of you saying everything you thought you know about the brain and the mind and how we perceive and who we are and all that, it's actually not true. Or at least it's not that it's not true, it's a very limited way of thinking about what we're actually capable of. And so I decided I can't drop it. I mean, I will continue to study this one way or the other for as long as I can. And so the second miracle is the most amazing psychic thing I've ever seen is my career. Because as we speak now, I've been doing this for about 40 some years as a scientist, and I'm paid to do it. So that's strange because there is no career track. There's no place you can go to university and then expect to continue doing this kind of work. That just doesn't exist. And yet somehow it has existed for me. So I think of it in terms of a very clear intention that has manifested a career to get me paid to do what I want to do.
Wow, yeah. It's like kind of like with what you were saying in that there, like the world is full of outliers, extraordinary people, and we seem to only focus on those that have like physical outliers. Like we prize like star athletes, like we like Usain Bolt, fastest guy in the world. We've got, and we know the perimeters and the dynamics behind what creates a good athlete. If something like that, where it's like when we were look like physiologically, we're looking at like fast twitch muscle fibers, and we know how the rate of contraction, we got the VO2 max. We can look at all these different perimeters for physical intelligence, for athletic ability. What's from your experience, like there's other forms of intelligence, body intelligence, you've got IQ, you've got emotional intelligence, and then we seem to have like a spiritual intelligence. What's the sort of fundamental sort of dynamics, the underpinning perimeters that you believe is what creates someone who's gifted within this realm? If they got things that, is there anything, any sort of things that popped up throughout your research where you can kind of piece it together and they have stuff in common? Is there anything like that?
So when the classified program was going, that question was asked a lot because we were able to find a half a dozen people who were very highly talented, mainly by searching through the army to find people who answered questions in a certain way. So you can imagine you could give people 50 questions, and if they start answering yes to enough of them, then you figure that at least they're a candidate. But every medical and psychological test that we knew those people took to find out what discriminates somebody who is a super psychic from somebody who has no skill at all. So there's some personality differences, but we couldn't find any physical differences at all. And they had every medical test we could think of. Well, that was quite a while ago. Now we actually do have some inklings that people who are very highly talented are probably a kind of mutation, a genetic mutation.
Interesting.
This sounds, I mean, and there are a number of reasons why this is probably the case, but it sounds a little strange because it's as though there are X-Men among us. Yeah. The thing is that there are lots and lots of genetic mutations. In fact, almost all of us have at least one mutation from, if there's some standard DNA, there are millions of mutations. And that accounts for one of the reasons why people are different. So in this case, we know that psychic ability runs in families. It's not known to a very high level of confidence, but there are lots and lots of stories that persist for a long time that somebody's grandmother and her grandmother and so on, that people in families seem to have these abilities. What's not completely clear is whether it's nature or nurture. So if the nurturing is that people allow you to talk about your experiences openly, well, that may encourage people to talk about psychic experiences. But we now also have evidence that it's probably a genetic basis as well. So one of the more recent findings, which is extremely strange, and we're still in the process of tracking it down, is that there is a morphological difference in the brain of people with high talent. And when you have a morphological difference, means that there's the structure and even shape of the brain is actually different in high talented people than not high talented. That tells you that it's almost certainly a genetic trait. So you can change the structure of your brain if, for example, you meditate for 20 years. The connections in the brain will be different than if you don't. Or if you play an instrument, a musical instrument, there are different connections in your brain. It's happening all the time. But here we're talking about not just connections, but actual different tissue in different locations in the brain in highly talented people. The way this came about was that there are people in every country who have positions of very high authority where they have to be psychologically and physically sound. I'm talking about people who are in missile silos and other people who, like aircraft pilots and so on, they're checked periodically to make sure that they're still well grounded psychologically, they're physically okay, and so on. Because if they're not, then other people's lives are put at danger. So in the process of having a periodic exam, especially people in things like nuclear missile silos, they have discussions with psychiatrists and counselors to check what's going on. And they're taught that in order to maintain their job, they have to admit everything. Anything that's going on, if you don't want them to be compromised by a spy, you don't want them to suddenly getting drunk, all of that is checked, and both physically as well. It turns out that some people, and this is a very small percentage, about 1 in 2,000 of these people, occasionally they'll say that they're psychologically, they pass the exam, physically, they pass the exam. Talking to the counselor or the psychiatrist, everything seems perfectly normal, except that they will admit that, oh yeah, last Tuesday we were in the silo and a glowing orb came through the wall and started talking to us telepathically. Well, you could see that a psychiatrist would be a little bit concerned about that. That's a red flag. You're not supposed to talk to glowing orbs. or worse, a fairy came through the wall, or a gremlin or something. Mm-hmm. And so this is said by somebody who passes every known psychological and physical health test. Well, so those people go to a second level. They get a brain MRI, they do other kinds of things. All of that information from these strange cases are sent to one person who's a specialist at reading MRIs to see if there's like, maybe their brain went funny. So he's looking at these cases. There are now about 150 such cases. And he found, to his amazement, that there's a commonality in the brains of these people. They're normal in every way, except for the fact that they're seeing fairies and goblins and telepathic orbs and stuff. They have a portion of the brain which is different than in normal people. And the similarity across all of these people is the same. It's the same portion of the brain, which is has a different density of neurons, and it looks different, it's morphologically different, which says that they're probably a similar kind of genetic mutation. So that's good news from the point of view of saying, well, yeah, these people really are different. They are structurally different. So when they're talking about that they could appear to be completely normal, as, for example, a person who saw this giant submarine, by every external appearance and talking to him, you would never, ever guess that he was a super psychic. But his brain is not normal. He has something else going on. And his sister did as well. So again, suggesting a genetic connection. So we're trying to track down what would that genetic factor be. There now, because we can look not only at genes, but we can look at constellations of hundreds of genes, which may give a clue as to how these people are different. In addition, the moment that you find there's a genetic difference, there's a possibility of stimulating that difference in a brain that doesn't have it. You could do genetic engineering, you can do various kinds of training, neurofeedback, and so on, to stimulate that portion of the brain and maybe take a person who's not normally psychic and make them psychic, as a result, targeting that area. And the flip side is that some people are driven crazy because they can't stop the psychic connection. They will be diagnosed as schizophrenic because they'll be talking about things like, well, I'm hearing the thoughts of people as I walk past them in the street. If you tell that to a psychiatrist, you will be diagnosed as schizophrenic. Mm-hmm. And then they will give you drugs which will suppress that ability to a minor extent, but it will never turn it off. So if we knew that there was a genetic basis, we would have a way of turning off that specific ability without sedating the person. Because a lot of the psychiatric drugs basically are sedation, and no one likes to be on that because it makes you feel groggy all the time. So we may find a way eventually to turn on or turn off very high accuracy psychic awareness. What we don't know at this point is whether we can do the same thing for psychokinetic effects. It seems to be almost a different class, but at least for perceptual type psychic effects, we can now see a path where we may be able to significantly amplify it.
Wow. Yeah. Just out of interest, Dean, with I don't know if there's any correlation in this. It's just, this is something within my own line of just kind of going down the rabbit hole on this one. Have you personally found any correlation between people that have rhesus negative blood and having extra sensitivity to psychic phenomena?
Blood tests were one of the things that were looked at back when. This is the mid-80s, and they weren't found. The correlation was not found, not systematically, no.
Interesting, because it seems to be, again, it may be like confirmation bias almost, in that a lot of the a lot of people that do have rhesus negative blood, they all say they experience these sort of extrasensory perceptional abilities. They say that they have they go lucid in their dreams a lot, astral project a lot. In fact, what have you got any insight on what astral projection's about?
Well, it's the perception of leaving your body in a different body, the astral body. What we don't know is whether in all of these cases of altered states, we don't have a way of directly testing what the subjective experience is like. So the answer is we don't know. What we can do is test whether if somebody goes into what they say is an astral travel, can they get information which they describe, which we can later verify? So in that case, the answer is yes. Regardless of the method by which somebody gets information from a distance, that can be verified. But as to their actual subjective experience of being a body, we don't know how to verify that. So maybe it's true, maybe it isn't.
Interesting. Because I'm sure you're familiar with Thomas Campbell, right? In the Monroe Institute. And that's something that they were doing a lot of interesting research into back in the day. And yeah, I was just wondering if you'd stumbled across anything in your own line of research that kind of coincided with their findings. And I'm just keeping a little eye on the time, and we're pretty close to having to tie this one up, Dean. And I was wondering, just to finish this one up, I'd like to know, because what your opinions are on, I don't know if you've got any experience in this, or if this is something that you've taken any time to look any further into. What's your opinion on using Ayurvedic herbs, using all of these different sort of ancestral herbs that have been around for a long time in order to heighten your sensitivity to these subtle energies. So, like, for example, one of the main Ayurvedic herbs that they say it's good for increasing your psychic ability is Shilajit. And what Shilajit has in it is a compound called fulvic acid. And the fulvic acid is what that allows it to do, is it dilates the cellular membrane, stretches it out, and that you can re-then pull in, essentially, if you're doing certain practices, photons and electrons into the cell. And that is going to be able, if depending on what your views on photons are, you're channeling information directly into your cell on a microcosmic level. And I was wondering, do you buy into any of that in terms of certain foods, certain herbs that allow you to increase your psychic ability, maybe not directly, but indirectly?
I would say there's a lot of lore
about
this. Sometimes the lore is correct and sometimes it isn't. So the answer is, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Because there hasn't been enough systematic research to know for sure that these ancient methods, whether it's some kind of herb or something, whether it actually works. We also don't know, by the way, that even though it's often reported that drugs like psilocybin or LSD will make people more sensitive to these phenomena, we don't know that that's true either. I mean, there are a lot of reports about it. I suspect that it's true, but until we do experiments where we can verify whether it is or not, at this point it remains in the realm of, well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And in general, when somebody asks a question like that, I say, does it work for you? Try it. For some people, it will work. What we don't know is maybe it works because you think it's going to work. It's a placebo effect. Well, placebo effects are very powerful. And so if taking a certain herb or wearing a certain button or something is the thing that works for you, go for it.
Interesting. All right. So, just one last thing as well before we call this one quits, Dean. What are you up to nowadays? Like, have you got any research on the go right this moment? Is there anything that you're excited to, like, share in terms of maybe something that you stumbled upon and is really taking you down a new path or new interest? Is there anything? Yeah, like, what's going down in the lab at the moment?
Well, I have four experiments going on now. They're all looking at mind-matter interaction in various ways. They're essentially physics experiments because they have to do with the interaction between mind and light and various kinds of optical apparatus. I don't think there's anything special about light in this case. I mean, photons, sometimes electrons, but they're convenient targets to work with because you can create a system that is exquisitely sensitive to any kind of external influence. And so you isolate that system and you very carefully prepare it in a way so that ordinary influences cannot do anything to it. Mm-hmm. And then you have a subject at a distance who is asked to try to interact with it mentally. And so being very sensitive systems, and they become very good ways of detecting if something in fact changed its behavior in accordance with the instruction of the person at a distance. So let's see, I guess three of the four experiments involve light and one involves electrons. So those are the active experiments I have running.
Interesting. Yeah. So for people that are like, that's been interested in what you've had to say today, like, where can they catch more about you and your research, keep up to date with the latest findings? I know you've got your own personal website, the website for the Noetic Institute of Science. It's there. Like, where can people find more about you if they want to, if someone is brand new to who you are, out of all your books that you've wrote, is there any that you would suggest is good for a first read as well, just to introduce your sort of what you're about?
Well, probably my most recent book, Real Magic.
Yeah.
All of them are intended for a general population. So you could start with any of them. But I recommend Real Magic and my website, realmagicbook.com. Up until recently, I see in Amazon UK that the book was rated at 5 stars with people, and then one person came along and gave it 1 star. It's not too surprising because it's a controversial topic, and some people just cannot wrap their mind around the idea that science can study something like magic. Well, I describe in great gory detail that, in fact, it can study magic and that we can reach some conclusions about it. So realmagicbook.com will discuss all of the other books, gives something about all of the books I've written and some of the bio. If you just start searching on the internet for my name, you're going to find all kinds of strange stuff. I mean, I looked on YouTube and found like 10,000 videos that have my name in it in some way. I have no idea where these things come from. And the same goes for most of the websites. I don't know how it shows up, but somehow it's there. And so you can find out more than you ever wanted to know, some of which is true. Probably a lot of it is not so true. So my caution about learning through the internet is just take everything with a grain of salt.
Yeah, you got to, that's what I tell people as well. Like, it's one of the main things for this is that everything that I say and the guest says, you got to kind of find your own truth of it. Like, you got to do your own research. Don't just take everything we say as the golden truth. Find out what works for you. There's going to be a lot of things that you say that I say that might resonate with people on a deep level. And then it's all about developing your own intuition and being able to, yeah, really calibrate your bullshit meter to know who can talk the talk and who's actually walking the walk with the information they're putting out there. And it's, yeah, for yourself, I love that, yeah. As I said earlier, Dean, it's like very respect your work and the years, the time that you've put into this and just everything overall, what you're doing to be able to get this information out there in a way that logical, analytical people can be drawn into this subject, because these subjects are ones that are normally scoffed at within the realm of science. People wouldn't give them the time of day normally. So the fact that there are people out there that are putting in legit work and using scientific principles in order to, yeah, with no preconceived ideologies attached to it, it's amazing. And there's going to be, I'm sure there's a lot to come as well out of your own research and everyone else at the Institute as well. So yeah, I think we'll give this one we're tying this one up now. So I just want to say a massive thank you for coming on again, Dean. And guys, hopefully you've really enjoyed this one. It's again, this is only the beginning. We're going to keep going deeper down the rabbit hole with this. So Dean was a good one to introduce you to some of the concepts. And now we're going to, in the few episodes we've got lined up coming up, it's going to be, we're going to go a little bit more woo woo on this and see what we can discover and rediscover along the way. So yeah, Dean, any last words for anyone?
Keep on keeping on.
Yeah. Wow. That's good advice. You heard it there, guys. Keep on keeping on. Stay woke as fuck as always. And I'll catch you next time on the next episode. Peace.